This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hello, this is Liz, and I'm here with Dr. Paulo Freire from the Max Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy in Bonn. He did his PhD here in Manchester, and then he worked 8 years in Arecibo in Puerto Rico in one of the biggest radio telescopes. And he gave a talk last week about how to use pulsars to test general relativity. So how are you, Paulo?
Hi, Liz. I'm doing great. And congratulations to you for running this. And hi to everyone listening.
Thank you. So tell us, Paulo, tell us a little bit about a pulsar and how do you use them to test general relativity?
Pulsar is an extremely interesting thing. So it's basically a neutron star. So neutron stars are the end stages of the evolution of very massive stars. So we can think of them as basically, they formed in a supernova, and we can think of them as a giant atomic nucleus. So we normally have matter made of small atoms. They have a nucleus of protons and neutrons, and then they're surrounded by electrons. In the case of a neutron star, something very dramatic happens at the end of the life of a star. The star explodes in the supernova, and in the core, you have just this immense gravity of this dead star, crushing the atoms together. So powerful is this gravity that it overcomes the repulsion between all these nuclei, and essentially they all crush together, and we have the product is this enormous. It really is like an atomic nucleus. So it's made of protons and neutrons, and it has some electrons at the outer edges. And so to have an idea, it's something with a diameter of a few kilometers, something like 30 kilometers. And the mass of this thing is something like 500,000 times as massive as the Earth. So we really Wow. have densities in the core that are something like a few hundred million tons per cubic centimeter.
Wow.
So these objects are really extremes of every kind of physics we know. I mean, that's really where we can test gravity, we can test quantum mechanics, we can test our knowledge of nuclear forces. A pulsar is a neutron star for which we can see some kind of pulsations, normally caused by the rotation of the object.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about the pulsar is emitting radio waves and other kinds of waves, gamma rays and X-rays through its magnetic poles. And so every time it rotates, we can see some pulsations. It's a little bit like a lighthouse.
Okay.
And a lighthouse is always emitting light, but we only see pulses when it's pointing towards us.
Yeah.
So that's how it works. The main feature that we prize about these pulsars is how regularly they rotate.
Okay.
In some cases, they can be stable in the long term as atomic clocks, or perhaps even better. We still don't know. That is the feature that makes them extremely useful for a whole range of astrophysical experiments.
Okay. So what was the main thing that you used this pulsar or this? Because you were talking about a binary system, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how is this binary system made of, and what are the two different stars, or then how do you use them to test the general relativity?
Before we started the conversation, I gave a talk here at the Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics last Friday. And I was talking about a particular binary system called PSR J1738 plus 0333. So in this system, we have one of these pulsars, a really fast spinning one, something that rotates about 180 times per second.
Wow.
So just so to have an idea how fast, I mean, some of them can rotate very, very fast. I mean, the record holder rotates 716 times per second.
Wow.
So we have one of these pulsars being orbited by a white dwarf star. So a white dwarf is also some kind of dead star, but still made of atoms. It's still not as extreme as a neutron star. So instead of a few hundred million tons per cubic centimeter, you have a weight similar to almost a ton per cubic centimeter. So it's still extremely dense, but they are objects that are much closer to our realm of existence than a Newton star. So this particular system I was talking about was discovered in 2001 using the Parkes radio telescope in Australia. So this was doing a survey of the large portion of the sky, and it found this binary system 1738 plus 0333, which I have been studying ever since. The interesting thing about this system is that you have a pulsar and a white dwarf, but they have a rather short orbital period of about 8.5 hours.
Okay.
Even more interestingly, we can detect the white dwarf using regular telescopes, like the Very Large Telescope in Chile or the Gemini telescopes in Chile and Hawaii. And the Companion is a relatively bright star, magnitude 20.
Okay.
So it's within the reach of many amateur astronomers. So the interesting thing is, with a professional telescope, we can look at this star, at the Companion star, and looking at this spectrum, we can measure the temperature of the star, and we can even measure, by looking at the shapes of the lines, the surface gravity of the white dwarf.
Yeah.
So this tells us something about its mass and radius.
Yeah.
Once we know the surface gravity, we can have a strong constraint on that, because we know, have a very good idea of what should be the relationship between mass and radius of a white dwarf. And we look at this one in particular, and we can measure the surface gravity, so we can determine independently those two quantities. We can also, by doing that, so we can measure the mass of the white dwarf, we can also measure the spectral lines from the white dwarf. So most people listening will be familiar with Doppler shifts. So we can see how the orbital velocity of the white dwarf changes with time. So this, combined with the measurements from the pulsar, which are extremely precise, we can measure the orbit of the pulsar very precisely. This gives us the ratio of the masses. Knowing the white dwarf mass, knowing the mass ratio, we can calculate, of course, the pulsar mass. So just to give you an idea, the pulsar mass seems to be very... It seems to be the kind of usual mass that we've detected for a lot of other neutron star masses. It's about 1.4 times the mass of the Sun, which is close to the Chandrasekhar limit. So this is the limiting mass for a white dwarf, after which it will become unstable and collapse,
yeah,
and form a neutron star. So this was the unusual thing about this system. We were able to measure the mass of the white dwarf, measure the mass of the pulsar, and we know all the other parameters with very good precision. We know the orbital period to a precision of a fraction of a microsecond.
Wow.
We know the
okay.
spin period with 16 decimal places. We really have, from the timing of this pulsar, we can measure a lot of its parameters with extreme precision. The orbit of this thing has a radius of about 102,000 kilometers. And we know that it does not deviate from a circle by more than 5 micrometers. So it's probably one of the most circular things we know of.
Wow.
It's an extremely circular orbit. So just the way we test Einstein's general relativity is that we know this orbit very precisely. We know the masses. So using Einstein's general relativity, you can predict that this orbital period of about 8.5 hours should decrease every year by about 0.8 microseconds, 0.86 microseconds, something like that.
Very precise.
It's very precise. And after 10 years measuring this orbit precisely, we have been able to measure the rate at which this orbit is decreasing, because it's losing energy by emission of gravitational waves. This is gravitational waves was a big discovery in the 1970s. We can measure for this system that it is also, like several other binary pulsars, it's losing energy. And the rate at which we measure is 0.8 plus or minus 0.1 microseconds per year. So it's in absolute agreement with Einstein's general relativity.
That's very interesting. So with this thing, can you test other theories to kind of use all these measurements and say, well, this theory doesn't fit, or this theory also fits?
It's a very good question, because this is one of the things that makes this system shine that tells it apart from other binary systems. So in other binary systems, like a double neutron star systems or the famous Hulse-Taylor pulsar, this was the pulsar that gave the 1913 plus 16, that's the name of the pulsar. Mm-hmm. This was the system that earned Russell Hulse and Joe Taylor, their discoverers, the Nobel Prize in Physics. That system was an excellent system for testing general relativity. But many of the alternative theories of gravity that we have nowadays yield the same predictions for the rate at which the orbit of these kind of pulsars should be shrinking with every year. Because that particular pulsar, 1913 plus 16, is a double neutron star system. So we have a pulsar, and then we have another neutron star, which we cannot observe. If it's emitting radio waves, they're not aimed at the Earth.
Okay.
So we have these two neutron stars orbiting each other, and you know, alternative theories predict that they should decay at a rate very similar to what we observe. The nice thing about the study that myself and others have been involved with 1738 plus 0333 is that it is a pulsar with a white dwarf as a companion. So because we have this white dwarf companion, these alternative theories predict that for such a system, the orbit should be decaying at a rate that is faster than what we observe. So instead of 0.8 microseconds, the orbit should be losing a larger rate, larger rates of about, in some cases, 5 microseconds a year or so. And we don't observe this.
Okay.
So we can place constraints or in some cases exclude some of these alternative theories of gravity using the measurements that we've done for 1738. So it's a very clear result.
Yeah, that's really good. So what's going to happen to the system afterwards? Is it going to collide something?
Yes, we've calculated the time. So it's because it's losing gravitational waves at this rate, at about 0.8 microseconds per year, the white dwarf will approach the pulsar, mm-hmm. and in about 15.4 billion years, the white dwarf is going to be torn apart by the very strong tide from the pulsar. So it will form a disk of matter around the neutron star. And then what happens to that disk of, to that very dense disk is some of it will end up on the surface of the neutron star. Some of it will be, most of it probably will be blown away, blown apart. And there is a possibility, there is recently a result where some of the scientists here at the Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics were involved, where they find a diamond planet. In a very short orbital period, you might have to the Jodcast might have heard something about that. It is possible that the system might one day form something like the diamond planet. So some of these matter as the star, as the remainder of the white dwarf is being blown apart, it will go farther, a little bit farther away from the neutron star, and it will form just a small core with a
carbon core.
Yes. So it's going to have an interesting end.
Brilliant. Amazing. And can you tell us a little bit about how to detect the gravitational waves?
Yes. So we know from binary pulsar experiments that I was mentioning before that the orbit of the binary pulsar gets shorter in time with time, and that it shrinks at the exact rate predicted by general relativity. And so this tells us that the mechanism that general relativity tells us is shrinking the orbit is emission of gravitational waves. So since the 80s, where this was first measured precisely for 1913 plus 16, we've known that there are gravitational waves. But the measurement is very indirect. So all we see is some binary pulsars out there that have some orbital period, and we see this orbital period decreasing at the exact rate predicted by general relativity. And presumably, it's because of the emission of gravitational waves, but we have not, until now, detected them directly. Of course, the binary pulsar experiments give us confidence that gravitational waves exist, but we haven't seen them directly. So, as most listeners might know, there's a set of large and very expensive experiments going on now called LIGO, Virgo and others. There is even a proposed satellite mission called LISA. These experiments aim to detect gravitation waves directly. So if there was a gravitation wave going through me right now, if it was coming from the front, I would get a little bit taller and a little bit skinnier at the moment, which would be my favorite configuration. But then half a cycle later, I'll be a little bit fatter and shorter. Okay. So the material object would oscillate between these two states. And so these changes produced by gravitational waves are tiny. And in order to detect them, we need to build a very high-precision instrument called an interferometer. So they're looking at oscillations that are smaller than even the nucleus of an atom. So they have to be extremely sensitive and have to be able to really dig into data. So this is an extremely challenging measurement. That's why no one has yet achieved the direct detection of a gravitational wave. But, you know, hopefully we'll be able to do that soon. We can do this also by timing binary pulsars, by timing millisecond pulsars out in space. Because if such a wave is going through the solar system, then it will change the distances in our local neighborhood. Yeah. So we will be able to see some pulsars from some directions in space coming in late. The pulses will appear to come in late and from opposite directions at 90 degrees, we would see the pulses arriving early.
Yeah.
And then half a cycle later, we'd see the situation reversing. So millisecond pulsars have this interesting property that they generate gravitational waves when they're in a binary system, but they can also be used to detect them directly. But this kind of gravitational waves that we can detect with pulsars have periods of many years. While with the detectors we have here on Earth, we can only sense gravitational waves with periods of fractions of a second, hundreds of a second or a thousandth of a second, because that's the size of the detector. It's a few kilometers, so you have to think about light going over 4 kilometers of the detector. That's the kind of frequency you can see. That's the size of the object generating it. The size of the detector gives you the size of the object you want to detect.
Yeah. And do you think it could be another explanation, like when the binary system is orbiting around it and is losing energy? Could it be something else apart from gravitational waves? Or
No. If we accept general relativity, then there is no other way of producing this orbital decay. I mean, the match between the measured and predicted rates of orbital decay is just wonderful. It's really an extremely precise match, and it really gives us very good confidence that we understand what is happening. So there is no other way of even starting to make a calculation if you don't assume that, you know, it's some distortion of space-time itself that has a wave behavior and that's propagating outward from the binary. So about 1738, one of the reasons why this experiment is important is because many people have been debating about fundamental issues in the universe like dark matter, dark energy.
Yeah.
These are very important questions, of course, because dark matter and dark energy make up 96% of the contents of the universe. And the question is the universe really filled with all these unseen forms of matter that we cannot detect in any form? I mean, this sounds very weird.
Yeah.
Or could it be something wrong that we don't know about, for instance? Could it be that our understanding of gravity is wrong? And we don't really know how, I mean, if Einstein is wrong, if general relativity doesn't work as advertised, then we could imagine situations where modifications, relatively small modifications of gravity, can give us all these phenomena, like dark matter and dark energy, for free, without needing to evoke all these extra stuff. So over many years, many people have come up with theories of gravity that behaves in a slightly different way than general relativity, and that can naturally explain all of these phenomena, like dark matter and dark energy.
Yeah.
An example is MOND, Modified Newtonian Dynamics. This is has been a discussion that has been going on for since 1983, when this concept was first proposed by Professor Milgram. And since then, people have been debating whether this theory really can explain away dark matter, or if we really need dark matter, and gravity is behaving as we expect. And so this theory has relativistic extension, tensor vector scalar theories. One of the conclusions that we've reached in our recent study is that if we combine several different binary pulsar experiments, we can exclude this tensor vector scalar theory.
Okay.
This theory is the relativistic version of MOND, Modified Newtonian Dynamics. So if we exclude one, we exclude the other, almost. There might be some kind of relativistic formulation that we don't know of MOND, but the two things are linked. So I think this has importance for our knowledge of how the universe works, and not only because we understand gravity better, but because also we have a better understanding of dark matter. We know it's not a distortion of gravity. Okay. We know it's something that's real, that it's out there. We haven't detected it, but it's likely there to be some kind of particle that we just haven't been able to detect yet. But, one day we might. So.
But yeah, it's really interesting that you can actually rule out other theories. So you can just focus in finding dark matter,
that is,
or dark energy.
That is the process of science, right? I mean, people formulate hypotheses and, accumulate evidence and they become theories. But, theories don't conform to experiment. They fail.
Yeah.
So that this is science at work. I mean, I'm very glad to be in a position where we can actually sort between different alternatives and advance our knowledge of how nature really works.
Brilliant. Well, very good interview. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for your time as well.